From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, our focus is on North Carolina Senate District 9, which includes most of New Hanover County. Not part of District 9 is the largely Democratic African American neighborhood in downtown Wilmington that, as described in detail during our Senate District 8 edition, is 2.6% of New Hanover County voters. In 2014, Republican incumbent Michael Lee beat his Democratic challenger by nearly 11 percentage points. That was after getting the appointment months earlier when Tom Goolsbee resigned. In 2016, Michael Lee beat his Democratic challenger, Andrew Barnhill, by an even wider margin, nearly 15 percentage points. This year, Lee faces two challengers on the November ballot. Democratic nominee Harper Peterson and Libertarian candidate Ethan Bickley are with us today. We will meet the candidates in alphabetical order. Ethan Bickley says he filed for office at the 11th hour. He currently works for a tech startup at Tech Mountain after spending 12 years in the military and private security. And just last spring, he finished his MBA at UNCW. Ethan Bickley, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much for having me, Rachel.
Why are you running in this election? You say you filed in the 11th hour. What was it that made you decide to do that?
Well, one reason was nobody else was doing it. So it was
as a libertarian.
Correct. So it was a bit of a for me, it's a bit of a way to get back into public service because most of my services ended as far as. This my service ended about 5 years ago. So it's a way for me to get back into public service.
Why, first of all, run as a libertarian for a state elective office? I mean, this is something I don't think any libertarian has successfully done. No libertarian has actually won state office in the House or the Senate in North Carolina.
Correct. One reason why I enjoy being a libertarian is that I think it is a bit of a refreshing perspective that is separate from the status quo with the Republicans and Democrats.
What are some examples of the libertarian take on statewide issues? For instance, offshore drilling for oil and gas. Is that something as a libertarian that you would support?
I would support making sure that people's private property is protected. That is a huge tenet in the Libertarian Party. So if there are things that are going on that would damage the environment or people's private property and or people's private property, then I would be opposed to those types of things. Additionally, though, for another example, the opioid crisis here is a very large problem. It's not only just a problem for the people that are addicted to it, to that substance, but it's also threatening the general safety of the public. So we need to think of other. I feel like as a libertarian candidate, we have to. We should critically think about these issues, and try and do things trying to provide a solution in a new way. So, for example, I would support opioid and David Reeser. And how he is using artificial intelligence to combat the opioid epidemic.
How does that work?
Well, I'm not exactly the most technically savvy person out there. however, he's basically—
You work for a tech startup.
I work in marketing and sales for a tech startup.
Fair enough.
but basically the way he explained it to me very briefly— very, very briefly, is that they're going to draw data from different databases in an effort to remedy the problem with that. So you'd really have to talk to him more about it because it's a little bit more complicated than that.
One of the key issues for people in Senate District 9 is clean drinking water. It was relatively recently that the public learned there were unregulated chemical compounds in the water that are probably dangerous to human health. And there have been all kinds of responses and non-responses to that. The Water Safety Act was recently passed in Raleigh, and that was legislation sponsored by Republican incumbent Senator Michael Lee. What do you think about that particular piece of legislation? And if you could move the ball down the field on the emerging contaminant issue, how would you do it?
Honestly, I had not looked at that piece of legislation, so I can't. I'd rather not speak on it if I don't know what I'm talking about. However, from my perspective, as far as Gen X is concerned, or really any other private business that would potentially pollute our environment or damage a person's private property, as what we've experienced with Gen X, then obviously that business needs to be held accountable for that. They need to. They should compensate people if people's private property was damaged. So I think in the Gen X issue, or another maybe issue slightly less similar to that, the two truths that we have to accept is that the business failed and they put bad stuff in the environment, and the government failed to stop them. So I feel like for the Gen X issue, the best way to combat that or remedy that is going to be a way to change behavior of business. And this is an interesting subject for me because I have an MBA. And it's not a good business strategy to destroy your own market. And that's essentially what ChemHours has done. My point is that we need to focus on how to change the behavior of some of these corporations, and they should understand that this is their market, it should be important to them, and that they should not want to damage it.
Part of the difficulty is that, you know, Gen X is one of the compounds that was discovered, but as researchers have explained to us, that makes up a tiny percentage of the actual chemical cocktail, the contaminant load that's in the drinking water supply. There are other compounds from other emitters about which we know very little or nothing.
Correct. Yeah, I actually had a bit of sponsored an educational forum about this at Waterman's Brewery a couple of months ago with a UNCW professor who is the guru on that stuff. And that's absolutely correct. There are other things going on, and people are putting other things into our water source.
So what should then the legislature's response be to those other? I mean, we know about ChemWars, and you know there are debates about how that's moving forward, and there are now things in place to check the water supply. But what about these other emitters? What do you do?
Once again, I think you've got to go back to try and change the behavior of some of these companies. Just because we don't know what the chemical compound is going to do, that doesn't make it okay for it to be in our environment.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with Ethan Bickley, Libertarian candidate for Senate District 9, which covers most of New Hanover County. Today's interviews are pre-recorded. One of the proposed constitutional amendments on the ballot would reduce the maximum allowable tax rate to 7%. Is that an amendment that you would support this November?
Yes, and here's why. Taxes negatively impact gross domestic product, whether it is a state GDP or it is a national GDP. GDP is important to fund, well, taxes fund government's services. However, if we focused more on increasing GDP and not increasing taxes, then there would be more money spent in the government.
And so you think it's good practice to cap the tax rate at 7%?
Yeah, I think that taxes impact people negatively as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, across the board, it doesn't really matter. Obviously, they impact people negatively across the board, taxes.
Fair enough. Now, looking at those six constitutional amendments that are on the November ballot, First of all, they've faced public criticism and even battles in court before the language that now exists wound up on the ballot. All five former living North Carolina governors, which includes three Democrats and two Republicans, have spoken out against the two amendments that would transition judicial vacancy and state elections board appointment power to the legislature. Former Governor Jim Martin, a Republican, called the two amendments a scheme. And another Republican, Pat McCrory, asked legislative leaders not to hijack the state constitution. Would you agree with that position? Or do you think that, are there any of the other constitutional amendments on the ballot that you would support?
Which constitutional amendments specifically are you referring to?
Well, let's take the judicial vacancy and state elections board appointment power, transitioning that from the governor to the legislature.
I believe that that's when the legislature will appoint judges, a vacant judge seat, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so that's, well, we have a separation of powers in this country for a reason. So we don't necessarily want the judicial branch being too intertwined with the legislative branch. And I think that could be a not necessarily a beneficial idea.
What about the constitutional amendment to enshrine the right of state residents to hunt and fish? Is that something you would support?
I believe that people should be able to hunt and fish, absolutely.
Would you support a constitutional amendment?
Sure.
For that? What about health care? When you look at 34 states after the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, when that passed, they were given the option to expand Medicaid. In North Carolina, there are more than 625,000 North Carolinians who don't receive that benefit, even though they're eligible for that under current federal law. Would you vote to expand that? Why or why not?
Well, the Affordable Care Act has been very detrimental to small businesses. This is not necessarily, I'm talking on a national level, not necessarily a state level, but small. I personally know small business owners that are paying $30,000 to $40,000 each year in health insurance costs. That's outrageous, and the economic implications associated with that on small businesses is probably not going to be good in the future.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with Ethan Bickley, Libertarian candidate for Senate District 9, which is most of New Hanover County. Do you think the General Assembly has a further role to play in bringing up North Carolina's standings in terms of being able to attract and keep excellent public school teachers?
Absolutely. Obviously, I think we would love to have excellent public school teachers.
And how should the legislature go about moving North Carolina forward that way? It's for years now, North Carolina has been viewed by, there's been something of a teacher exodus. Are you aware of that?
Not so much. I probably should be. But, we definitely do not want to lose any teachers, right? I also understand that there may be options in the private sector for education as well. I think we can look at the difference between private and public schools. And, obviously there has to be public education. I mean, we cannot get rid of public education. But I think that making more private education available may be beneficial. For an example, I have a friend of mine that has a child, and he would like his daughter to go to this private school. However, the waiting list is 700 kids long. So should this person be able to be denied his right to be able to send his kid to a private school because there are not enough private schools in the area? So I think there's as far as I think the teachers could get paid more in private schools. You can look at university level statistics for this, comparing maybe Duke to a public institution.
Do you think public school teachers should be paid more?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
How much more? How far does their pay need to go?
Well, this goes back to GDP and taxes. So, additionally, we also must. It's important for us to keep in mind that currently the Department of Education in North Carolina receives approximately 60% of the general fund. Second place there is Health and Human Services at 20%, and I think below that is Public Safety at like 12%. Or something. So, it's not as simple as just saying, well, I want teachers to get paid more. It's also like, well, I'd also like police officers to have better training. But at 12% of the general fund, well, that's what you get. But my point of my other, so let's bring taxes into this, and we'll talk a little bit more about GDP as well. So, if we raise GDP, the same percentage amounts will go to those same departments. The general fund will pay those certain departments of the state of North Carolina. Now, if we raise GDP enough, more money will, the same percentage amount will go, but the dollar amount will be higher.
And that's our time. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Ethan Bickley, thanks for joining us today and sharing your views.
Rachel, thank you so much for having me.
When we come back from this break, we'll meet Republican incumbent Senator Michael Lee. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. North Carolina's Senate District 9 covers most of New Hanover County. Republican Michael Lee was appointed to the post in the summer of 2014 after Senator Tom Goolsbee resigned. Senator Lee won the election that fall. 2 years later, he easily won his bid for a second term. As he seeks his third, he faces challengers from the Libertarian and Democratic parties. Senator Michael Lee co-chairs the Senate Education, Higher Education, and Senate Appropriations on Education, Higher Education committees. Other committees on which he's served include Commerce, Insurance, Transportation, Oversight, Judiciary, and State and Local Government. Senator Michael Lee, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you very much for having me today. I appreciate it.
Today's interview, as a reminder, is pre-recorded. Senator Lee, the majority of this year's Senate campaign seems to be focused on the drinking water supply, on emerging contaminants, and which side isn't or won't not taking care of constituents. You sponsored a bill that eventually became law known as the Water Safety Act. From where you sit, what does this do to ensure the safety of the drinking water supply?
Well, it's a rather broad act. It provides a lot of different things. Number one, it provides with what's essentially been kind of coined as an early warning system. And what it does is it provides water sampling at all the surface water intakes that are out there across the state, not just in our area, and also of the groundwater public municipal supplies or public supplies. And what that does is, as they're testing every quarter, that they will be able to test and deliver those results directly to the administration, the legislature, and more importantly to DEQ. So DEQ has the ability of seeing if there are anomalies or something that needs to be investigated or prosecuted. And then from that point, DEQ would then step in, do some of their own sampling for chain of custody reasons, and would be able to find out who the polluter was. That was a really important part of the legislation because, as you know, this has been going on for over 30-some years. And this kind of is a check and balance almost so that we know that someone is actually checking the water every quarter and the results are public. The bill also provided that all industry that discharges into – that has an NPDES permit or they can discharge into the river or surface waters, they've got to provide in a database format a list of all the compounds that they have disclosed and are going to put into that particular river or surface water. The reason that's so important is because right now you can't find that out very easily. What they do is they put it into a permit. They are filed either in paper or PDF, and there are thousands of permits, and you can't really search it. This would enable the CFPUA or any other water treatment facility, if something popped up or there was an anomaly, they could easily search and find out what has been disclosed by what industry as to what was being put into the water source. It gave the express authority to the governor to shut down bad actors, polluters.
And part of the issue that opponents of this legislation have is the notion of giving the governor that power in a separate state statute, because there already is a law that allows the governor through DEQ to shut down any company that he deems polluting too much. And the argument here is having a more specific law on the books that appears to just be targeting Chemours, the more specific law could be favored by a judge if there's a court challenge. And according to the News and Observer, that therefore limits the state's ability to shut down other potential polluters.
I've heard that argument. There's actually a very specific provision in the statute that addresses that, that says that essentially addresses that problem, that it does not in any other way limit any other potential remedy of the state against a bad actor. We ran it through the lawyers within the nonpartisan staff and just about everyone else. So we vetted that pretty clearly. But what we wanted to do is make sure that the governor, whether it's the current governor or a future governor, had that express authority and really felt like they had the ability to act. Certainly there's basic criteria by which the offender would have to just a basic criteria of what they're doing that triggers this authority, but certainly want to make sure that the chief executive of our state has the ability to move quickly.
There is also an argument out there from opponents of this legislation that says industrial lobbyists were able to help essentially craft this bill that would benefit them, and they were given three specific provisions that they asked for. And according to WRAL, Preston Howard, president of the North Carolina Manufacturers Alliance, also a former director of the Division of Water Quality, wrote to state legislators that broader testing of the water supply will, quote, almost assuredly reveal there are many, many chemicals, pharmaceuticals, and other consumer products in those water supplies, end quote. He warned you not to open a Pandora's box. And so you complied with that request?
Not at all. So the bill that I originally introduced was this statewide monitoring system for essentially all emerging compounds. What ended up in the legislation ended up dealing with the PFASs, or it's a family of compounds. Gen X is one of them, and there are over 5,000 of these. So through the legislative process, after I filed my bill, what ended up in the budget is that we had this strong mechanism put in place for monitoring all of our surface water and groundwater, and this would address all the PFASs and essentially set up the infrastructure and framework to do this. As we move forward, once we get a handle on the PFASs and through this monitoring process, they're also looking at a non-targeted analysis at other emerging compounds through this process.
Who is looking at that non-targeted analysis?
The university system is also pulling those samples for non-targeted analysis. And in fact, they were doing it right after the storm and looking at all the different surface water rivers primarily.
Are you talking about the North Carolina Policy Collaboratory?
Actually, the collaboratory really is just the framework for which the funding was provided, and what they do is they send the money out. So Dr. Canapi at NC State, Dr. Ferguson at Duke, I cannot remember the person's name at UNC Chapel Hill. There's also been some funding for toxicology that has come through the policy collaboratory to ECU. And then there's another grant that's been funded to NC State that's not a part of this. But once we set this framework up, they have the ability to pull these samples, and these samples will be on record in perpetuity so that they can go back and take a look at what they were able to find at a particular point in history in case they needed to. But the legislation that was ultimately passed really dealt with the PFASs and the 5,000 plus number of those compounds.
Right, which was part of the criticism, I think, because it's saying certainly there are plenty of the per- and polyfluoroalkyl compounds in the water. But there are also other classes of chemical compounds that don't fall into that category that are contaminants that are not regulated by the EPA or DEQ at this point. And you're narrowing your focus and saying, let's just not look at those other things?
No, there are some that are regulated and some that are not regulated. Some were in my original bill, the one for dioxane and pharmaceuticals. So what we were doing is we were setting up this network. My original bill had a much more expansive look at things through the legislative process. That did not make it through in the bill. But what we've got now is we've got this infrastructure, a robust infrastructure in place to do this sampling. And then we can expand that in the future, future legislative sessions, once we get our handle on that infrastructure and how we're pulling those samples. You know, I got this idea really in working with Dr. Ferguson at Duke University and looking at the Rhine River monitoring system that they used, which is a limited non-targeted analysis of emerging compounds within the Rhine River. It's multi-jurisdictional with different countries, and that's something that we really need to get to here in North Carolina. Certainly, we don't have multi-jurisdictional issues with the Cape Fear, but we do have them in other river sheds, and we need to be working with South Carolina and other states where we share those river sheds so that we can have this early warning system, not just as to the PFASs, as we've been talking about, but expanding it to all emerging compounds.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with Senator Michael Lee, Republican incumbent, seeking his third term in District 9, most of New Hanover County. Today's interview is pre-recorded. And another criticism from your opponents is the mass spectrometer that the legislature reluctantly funded was not the high-resolution tandem liquid chromatography mass spectrometer. It was a lower-end version that only seeks out a particular type of compound. And again, the argument is that it limits the scope of what can be detected. And Gen X, of course, is one of the compounds. And, you know, we've all heard from Dr. Canapi as well that Gen X only makes up a tiny percentage of the contaminants, the contaminant load in the Cape Fear River.
As to equipment and personnel, we did fund millions of dollars to DEQ for that particular purpose so that they could go in and do the targeted testing when an emerging compound was disclosed to them that they needed to go and find and enforce. Again, we've got the statewide monitoring process. It's reported to DEQ. DEQ reviews that, and then they're able to go out and actually take their own samples, as I mentioned a little earlier, use their mass spectrometer and their particular staff. One of the reasons it's important to include the university system is I don't in working with Dr. Canapi and Dr. Ferguson, it's not like you throw a sample into the machine and a light comes on and tells you exactly what it is. A lot of times, because these are emerging compounds, you actually have PhDs that are reviewing them and having to review them at a molecular level to actually figure out what they are and then report that out. So that's why it was great to have the university system. We're lucky in North Carolina because our scientists at State, UNCW, Duke, and others are at the cutting edge of emerging compounds. We have some world-renowned experts here in North Carolina. So while we're not lucky that we're having to deal with this problem, we are lucky that we've got the human capital resources within our university system and in some private institutions like Duke that can really assist us in this particular process. And if you listen to Dr. Ferguson, he had an op-ed in the Star News on Saturday. You know, this is an incredibly robust monitoring system that will be a model for the nation and he says the world. Again, we kind of patterned some of this against the Rhine River example that I gave a little bit earlier, which is a fixed permanent monitoring process. And hopefully we're going to get to that process as time goes on in North Carolina as well.
Looking at education in the state, of course, we know that North Carolina is still struggling in terms of being able to attract and keep high quality teachers. It's moved up a little bit. Certainly there's been a bump in teacher pay, but it's still not in the top half of the country. I mean, it's still sitting near the bottom in terms of the 50 states and how appealing North Carolina is. As chair of the Senate Education and Higher Education Committee, What do you think needs to happen at this point? Is this just a question of funding?
It's not just a question of funding, but historically, if we look at it, as we were leading up the 4 years or 5 years previous to 2011 or 12, we went through the downturn, and what you saw at that time was there was no savings reserve for our state. I think it was under $180 million at that time. And you saw that per pupil funding actually decreased for four straight years leading into 2011 to be right at the bottom. You also saw teacher salaries essentially frozen for that period of time with the exception of some longevity pay. So what we have been trying to do since 2014 is we've had five consecutive teacher pay increases, so we can kind of catch up, and I think we've moved 10 spots up in the national rankings in that regard. Billions of dollars have gone into per pupil funding, but it's really not just about how much money we spend, although that's an important component. Let's just take, I introduced a piece of legislation called the Renewal School District. And what that did was it gave a school district with a certain number of restart schools the ability to treat their whole district, in essence, much like a charter school, so that teachers could have more control over what was going on in the classroom from a curriculum perspective. Principals and assistant principals had more control over the management of their individual schools and school populations, and they would get the training to be able to do those things. I think that, and that's just one, what I would call a small example, innovation has got to also be patterned against funding. All the money in the world won't fix the problems. We've got to start doing things differently than we always have. If you look at classrooms today, they're not a whole lot different than when my mom was in a classroom. We've got some technological advances, but we've really got to be innovative in that regard. We're starting to work on the student funding piece or how the state funds education in North Carolina. Right now, North Carolina as a state, I think we're top 10 in how much we spend per capita. But where we're finding a shortfall is that in with our local governments, that's where we're kind of really moving down the scale. So we are working at the state level to find out, okay, how can we fix some of those problems? The Constitution puts that responsibility on the state, and the state legislature really needs to be the one to step up and do that through not just funding but innovative programs.
Gerrymandering. Recently, a court ruled that the most recent maps for the congressional redistricting plan made to ensure that states remain Republican, those districts. Is there any appetite for a nonpartisan process?
I think there is. And you know, as we move away from, you know, 100 years of one-party control, and now Republicans have been in control of the legislature, I do think that we are looking for ways to find out how can you establish a truly nonpartisan commission. There are some other states that are doing that, and we're looking at seeing at kind of what they're
You're
doing.
You're looking at it.
Looking
we're,
at it,
We're
yes.
just about out of time. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interview. Senator Michael Lee, thanks for sharing your views with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Stay with us. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're meeting the candidates today for North Carolina Senate District 9, which includes most of New Hanover County. Republican Senator Michael Lee has held that seat for two terms. As he seeks his third, he faces challenges from two candidates, a Libertarian and a Democrat, whom we'll meet now. Harper Peterson worked as an English teacher in Thailand before moving to New Hanover County in the 1970s. Over the decades since, he and his wife have built several local businesses. In the mid-90s, he served on Wilmington City Council. In 2001, he was elected mayor and served one term. Harper Peterson is a founding member of Cape Fear River Watch and Clean Cape Fear. He established the Northside Plan, the Affordable Housing Task Force, the Mayor's Task Force on Disabilities, the Mayor's Task Force on the Arts, and he served on the North Carolina General Assembly's Wilmington 1898 Race Riot Commission. He joins us now. Harper Peterson, welcome to Coastline.
Good morning. Thank you.
And just a reminder that this interview is pre-recorded. Harper Peterson, most of the advertising that voters are seeing around this race is focused on Gen X in the water supply and emerging contaminants and which side sold the people of the Cape Fear region down the river for a cozy relationship with industry. You, in your advertising, accuse Michael Lee of siding with Chemours instead of the people who drink the water. On what basis do you make those accusations?
Most recently based on his bill, Senate Bill 724.
The Water Safety Act.
Water Safety Act. The simple fact that the draft was presented to the North Carolina Manufacturers Alliance, a group of manufacturers, industries, 25, 30, including Chemours, it was given to them to review and edit. And they made three very important recommendations that were made, changes were made in that legislation. One, that this would be a narrow focus only around Gen X and the family of PFAS.
Right.
It would not include pharmaceuticals and other emerging chemical contaminants that have been studied, and it's important. We need to know what's in the water. I can't think of a more important thing than for people to know if the air is safe to breathe and water is safe to drink. That's a reasonable question.
And part of his argument for that is this is a first step around this most important class of chemical compounds. And once we have a model that works for this, then we'll expand the scope.
I wish we had 10 or 15 or 20 years to study this, but this is a crisis. It was a crisis when the story broke. It caught us all off guard, and the state knew about it. The state didn't communicate and share this information, DEQ, when the McCrory administration turned over the reins to the Governor Cooper. Secretary Reagan didn't know about it until June, I believe, 8th, when the story broke. That communication hadn't been passed on about Chemours and the studies that had been taking place. We do know that our local KFUR public utility did know about it, didn't say anything about it. And the fact that it's a close relative to C8, which is a known carcinogen in West Virginia, where the DuPont and the class action plaintiffs settled for $671 million. There should have been some red flags going up 2 years before this story broke.
So, and red flags for who specifically?
For Cape Fear Public Utility, for our state Department of Environmental Quality, DHHS, all the associated agencies that should be concerned and be acting regarding this.
And what is DEQ now, which was DENR for many years? Some say, Republicans argue, instead of more funding for permanent jobs at DEQ, which clearly didn't take care of the problem over the last three decades, they decided to fund other, you know, outside research and another body, the collaboratory,
right.
And the idea there is checks and balances. Doesn't that make sense, considering that DEQ, when it was under Democratic leadership, was not able to solve this problem?
We can look back, but the agencies are in place for a reason. They're regulatory, they create policy, they enforce regulation, they research and study. You have to be funded. You run any business, anybody knows this. You have to have funding to operate, to do your job. And what this General Assembly has done over the last 8 years is cut funding, cut staffing. It's crippled all these departments. And so creating another agency to study a disconnect from the agencies in place that can do the job doesn't make any sense. It's a delay. It's a diversion. It's not addressing the issue. Our water is unsafe to drink.
Another prong of your position around emerging contaminants in the water supply is repealing the Hardison Amendment, which doesn't allow the state to enact or enforce stricter regulations than the federal government has. Your opponent, Republican Senator Michael Lee, says actually in some critical cases, the Hardison Amendment does not apply, as in this case. And so the argument there is repealing the Hardison Amendment is a red herring when it comes to the drinking water supply.
With the policy at the national level, with EPA cutting back on regulation, a disinterest in environmental concerns, we are kind of left alone to take care of ourselves, and we need free rein there. Yes, in exceptional circumstances, the Hardison Amendment doesn't apply. But who's to decide that? Do we need to study that and debate that for another 6 months, 8 months, when there's a critical issue? We've seen what happened with Gen X when that story broke. My opponent was absent, along with the rest of our local delegation, for 7 weeks until the governor came and asked for emergency funding of $2.6 million. And Michael Lee and others stood next to him. And then suddenly it became politicized. He went away, went back to Raleigh, had new directions, new orders, and now we were diverting money, channeling it to our local utility company and university. Just delay and study, and I think that it's pretty evident now to most people who have followed this that this General Assembly and my opponent are really not interested in public health. They're more interested in the lobbyists and the special interests that support them and keep them in office.
In one of the ads that your opponent is running, there is a still photo of you with your arm around someone who is identified in that ad as a Chemours lobbyist. Can you explain that picture for us?
I'll be brief. His name is John Merritt. He's a lobbyist. I met him at a BOEM, a Bureau of Ocean Energy Management in Raleigh. This is when all coastal communities came to Raleigh to testify before BOEM, this national agency, with their opposition to offshore oil and drilling. And Mr. Merritt was there. I met him for the first time. There was a photo op. It was a rally with hundreds of people. That's it, beginning and end. So good shot. They caught me. But, you know, it wasn't at a Chemours rally or DuPont or whatever else it was intended to communicate.
And there's also an ad your opponent's running of people in a grocery store who essentially accuse you of not even living in the district. Can you explain that?
All I can say is I've been in Wilmington, in New Hanover County, for 45 years. We do have a home, a second home on Bald Head Island. So I guess I think everybody knows I live at 212 Orange and I've been there for quite a while.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. We're talking with Harper Peterson, Democratic candidate for Senate District 9. That covers most of New Hanover County. Today's interviews are pre-recorded. On your campaign website, Harper Peterson, you talk about initiating smart growth, enterprises that won't harm the state's natural resources. What is an example of that, and what role do state legislators play in getting that going?
Well, I think we have to finally address the fact, and Matthew and Hurricane Florence, I think, have brought this to the fore. We need to take seriously the reality of climate change, sea level rising. Climate sciences need to be part of our policy and our planning and our budgeting, not only at the local level, but the state and national level. We need to protect our coastal economies, our coastal resources, our coastal plains. And once we, you know, $13 billion is a hefty price tag of damages and recovery costs for this hurricane on top of a $4.8 billion recovery cost for Matthew. Once we get through this and we're up and running, and it's going to take time, obviously, but we can't redo the same thing, the way we respond to these events, these storm events. They're becoming more frequent, more intense. We need to really have a new, bold vision, a big vision on how we're gonna grow our communities, our economies, not only New Hanover County, but the region. I think it has to be a regional approach. We can't just say it. We need to engage Pender and Brunswick and Duplin and Sampson, all these counties, 25, 28 counties from I-95 to the coast. We need to work together, and that may be in development guidelines, how we build structures, new materials. And part of this discussion, and it's also an underlying element, is resources, energy resources. I think we need to turn the corner on fossil fuels, coal, natural gas, oil.
So are you talking about somehow incentivizing these alternative energy sources?
We do. I mean, solar and wind are at the forefront. But that's the way for the future. The rest of the world is passing us by. I mean, we can no longer rely on be dependent on fossil fuels.
And so it's fair to say you are an opponent of seismic testing and offshore drilling.
As well as the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which is a 600-mile natural gas from West Virginia through Virginia into North Carolina. Again, we cannot invest deeply in these fuels of the past. It's a new age, and these are jobs. These are clean. These are dependable resources. If you talk about data collection or cloud services, they use huge amounts of energy. This is reliable and dependable and clean and creates jobs. Solar jobs are the second largest growing job market in the country right now. The writing's on the wall. We need to get with it. And I think we need to buy into this as a community.
So you're talking about the state legislature saying, first of all, we're recognizing that climate change is affecting the severity of storms and we need to create more resilient communities.
Right.
But you're also saying you would create, in addition to possibly changing building codes or materials that are used, are you talking about creating more incentives for some of these businesses?
I think we do, and we obviously have to engage the existing utility companies that are providing that, okay? And we have to engage the financial institutions, everyone in the community. I mean, again, it's a discussion that's been suppressed by this legislature. They don't believe in climate change. They don't want climate sciences. They don't want to include that in their planning. And again, I think these two hurricanes have brought to the fore the crisis at hand. And looking forward, we can come out of this a stronger. People like to use that word strong. We can become a stronger community and state, but we have to get smart and look at other examples of success regarding these challenges. So again, we don't have to invent it or reinvent it.
How does the state attract and hire the best possible teachers? And what do you think teachers are looking for?
When I grew up in New York in a public school, I can say today, I think honestly say that any success I have had can be largely attributed to the teachers I had at a very young age, elementary school teachers, and I can name them, but regardless, they had an impact, they made an impression on me. These are people that are almost an extended part of your family. And they were then, and they should be now. These are passionate people that love their work. And we're doing everything to move them out of this profession. Either they're taking on jobs in the private sector, moving to adjoining states that pay more and provide benefits.
That was happening several years ago.
It's still happening.
Now the Republican majority says they've upped teacher pay, so it now is...
Teacher salaries have regressed about 9 or 10%, taking in inflation and just cost of living. We're at 50,000 and change right now for an average teacher salary. National average is 60,000. We've got some of the best universities and community colleges in the country, and our public school system is an embarrassment. And I understand teachers. I marched with them in Raleigh in the spring, 20,000 Republican Democrats, independents. They want to teach. They are the most important professionals in our community, more than doctors, attorneys, engineers, radio hosts, regardless. And we should treat them and pay them accordingly, period.
We have a question from David and Judy who say they've received flyers several times which accuse you of being sued for stifling other businesses and also refusing to pay over $20,000 in taxes.
It's erroneous and no basis for it. And, it comes from a third-party PAC, so I'm not going to dignify that. I don't know what to say.
Fair enough. Constitutional amendments. There are six of them on the ballot this November. Are there any that you support?
No, I don't. And even if I did, I would question the way they were rolled out. In the last week of a General Assembly, these are constitutional amendments that require public input.
One of them would enshrine the right of North Carolinians to hunt and fish. How can you oppose that?
Obviously, why is this a constitutional amendment? I think it's obvious why they were put forward, six of them. It's just to get out the vote of a certain political persuasion.
Capping the state income tax rate at 7%, considering the fact that the Republicans finished their last fiscal year with a surplus of $600 million.
Is it up to 600? I thought it was 450, but regardless, I mean, we don't know what the future holds. I mean, this hurricane has done a tremendous amount of damage and it cost involved. We need to keep that option open. I think both sides would agree. If we're going to be responsible service and providers, we need to have that ability.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Harper Peterson, thank you so much for sharing your views.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Senator Michael Lee and Libertarian candidate Ethan Bickley. Remember, early voting is underway. Election day is November 6th. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.